Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbc.com/programs/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and with me from our online tech desk are Jane Wakefield.
Hello.
And Dougal Shaw.
Hi there.
We've decamped this week. We've pitched our tent in the BBC's Blue Room, where all kinds of tests are carried out on the latest consumer gadgets. I'm surrounded by everything you can possibly imagine. We'll have a tour in a bit. Also with us, our special guest this week is the gadget guru, Stuart Miles, founder of the technology review site Pocket Lint, and he'll be giving you his insights on all the stories of the week. Stuart, a bit of a paradise for you here. It must be like your shed at home, isn't it?
It is. It's like everything I've seen in the last year in one room.
Very exciting. We'll let you play a bit later. But first, this week, Alibaba, the Chinese firm poised to be the biggest noise in online retailing. Here's its founder, Jack Ma, at a Credit Suisse conference explaining the difference between his firm and other, perhaps better known, e-commerce businesses.
People keep on asking me, what's the difference between China e-commerce and the US e-commerce? And what's the difference between Alibaba and Amazon and eBay? The difference between China e-commerce and the US e-commerce is that the e-commerce in the USA is a dessert. It's just a supplementary to their main business because the USA infrastructure of doing business is so good. But in China, because of the infrastructure of commerce is too bad, and e-commerce become the main cause.
So Jack Ma and Alibaba have been in the news this week because the firm filed documents for a public share sale in the US, and those documents were full of eye-popping numbers. Alibaba sold more last year than Amazon and eBay combined. It had 230 million users in China, 76% of the fast-growing mobile commerce market. Around the world, rivals are realising they need to be aware of the threat from the Chinese giant. So let's go first to our Hong Kong correspondent, Juliana Yu. Hi, Juliana. Give us first some more detail on just how big a player Alibaba is.
Well, Rory, here in China, Alibaba is really synonymous with online shopping, and online shopping in China is expected to overtake online shopping in America, possibly as early as this year. And you can imagine just how much money that is. As you mentioned, it controls about 75% of the entire e-commerce market, which works out to be just under $40 billion. Now, Alibaba runs a number of sites. One of them is called Taobao. It translates into digging for treasure, and essentially it's individuals transacting, buying and selling to each other. It also has Tmall, which is more like, you know, the likes of Marks and Spencer setting up an online shop. And every year on the 11th of November, Alibaba runs a special promotional day where, you know, they offer really enormous discounts. And over the last promotional day, they did almost $6 billion worth of sales on just one day. So you can see how big this is. And this is why, you know, investors, you know, may be paying a lot of money when it lists in New York.
An extraordinary platform then for all sorts of tiny e-commerce businesses. Now, you've met Jack Ma. Tell us a bit about him.
Jack is an extraordinary character. I met him for the first time more than 11 years ago. And Rory, he really is very different from other Chinese internet executives who are essentially Chinese clones of Mark Zuckerberg. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. People who usually study computer science, they are coders. They mostly have studied abroad in America specifically. Of course, they speak English. Jack is very, very different. He did go to university, but that's only after failing the National University Entrance Exam, not once, but twice. He does, as you've just heard, speak very fluent and sometimes often very colloquial English. And do you know how he learned this language? He did it by giving free tours to American tourists in his hometown of Hangzhou. And this is a character who thinks nothing of putting on an outfit that wouldn't look out of place on Michael Jackson and taking to the stage and singing a rock song. He's just such an exuberant personality, and he has an extremely direct way of speaking that, you know, in the Chinese cultural context is really unusual.
It really is, isn't it? Fascinating. Anyway, Juliana, thanks for that. But should the likes of Amazon be worried? Can Alibaba expand outside China? I spoke to Ezra Palmer from eMarketer, a marketing research firm.
We can certainly look around the world and say that there are multiple champions in individual markets. I don't think we're necessarily in a position yet to imagine that anybody could challenge Amazon in the U.S. in terms of e-commerce. They simply have a gigantic lead at the moment and hugely overshadow anybody else in this particular market. That's certainly not to say that that won't and can't change, but at the moment, Amazon is simply a behemoth that it's simply impossible to put anybody else at that same level.
Ezra Palmer, Stuart Miles, our special guest, quick word from you. Can you see Alibaba making an impact amongst Western consumers who buy the sort of gadgets you write about all the time?
I think what's really interesting is up until last week, most people have never heard of Alibaba, and they're coming into a number of incumbents in localized areas who have already got a very good distribution network, have already got click and collect, say, for example, in the UK, which retailers have done very well. And so they've really got to fight, even though they'll have the resources to do that.
One of a number of Chinese companies making strides all around the world. We've got to move on. Let's have a look at some of the other highlights of the week. To start, could this be rap's first billionaire? It's the one and only D.R.E. Now, who's that? Dougal, you're going to tell us what that's all about.
Yeah, those are the laid-back sounds of West Coast hip-hop as pioneered by Dr. Dre. Now, he was already a very rich man from his successful rap and producing career in the 90s. He went on to become even more richer in recent years because he co-founded a firm called Beats, which manufactures music equipment. It's best known probably for their headphones, which quite, you know, he does expensive models, and they're known as kind of fashion statements as well. Apple are rumoured, the rumours are this week, poised to make an acquisition of them for $3.2 billion.
And why on earth does Apple want a fancy headphone company when, you know, it's Apple doesn't buy big brands, does it? It buys small technology companies normally.
Yeah, I mean, as attractive as the headphones may be, what we think this is about is Beats just earlier this year set up their own streaming music service. And, you know, when it was about downloading music, Apple was supreme. They did very well with iTunes. Now all the growth and revenues from streaming, the likes of Spotify, Deezer, and they want a part of that action.
That's what it's all about. And although Apple's saying nothing, a video appeared briefly on Facebook a few hours ago of Dr. Dre himself celebrating, in rather profane terms, becoming what he called a member of the Billionaires Boys Club. And he said the Forbes list needs updating. So I think we can be pretty sure that is going to happen. Now, Jane Wakefield, Nintendo's been in the news for all sorts of reasons this week.
It has, and none of them particularly good, I'm afraid. So, first of all, it reported a net deficit of $229 million, largely due to the fact that it had much less demand for its consoles. Its Wii U console hasn't just not been hitting the market very well, and also its sales of its 3DS handset are down. So, I mean, that's all bad news for it. But on the other side of it, one of the games for its 3DS, one of the most popular games for its 3DS console in Japan, is got itself embroiled in a row. It's about to launch in the US and Europe, and one fan is complaining that he can't have a gay avatar and he can't marry his partner's gay avatar in the game.
And Nintendo weren't sympathetic to that complaint, were
they? No,
they?
Nintendo were not sympathetic. They said they had no intention of allowing that. He started a social media campaign to try and change its mind, but it's not a great week for the company.
And you're going to tell us about an even more exciting subject, net neutrality.
I know it's your favourite subject, Rory. Whenever we mention this, your eyes just light up. But actually, it has got very exciting this week because the FCC, which is the Federal Communications Commission and the telecoms regulator, basically, in the US, is looking at changing net neutrality rules, which would basically allow companies, ISPs, internet service providers, to charge a fee for some content to go on its network faster. And people are worried that this ends the principle of net neutrality, which is basically where all internet traffic should be treated equally. And there's been a huge furore about it, lots of people complaining, and a protest even outside FCC headquarters.
To be fair, it really is hotting up, that issue. I heard Tim Berners-Lee, the creator of the web, talking about that this week too. Now, Dougal Shaw, you've been looking into toilet technology.
Yes, I have. Now, this was a surprise hit on our BBC website this week. It was after I made the video. I spotted this device in a student design fair, and everyone at the fair was doing kind of virtual reality goggles and augmented reality, this and that. Then I saw one guy in the corner with a humble-looking toilet device. I thought, well, I felt a bit sorry for him. I'll check him out. And I went over to speak to him, and he's completely redesigned the toilet. And his concept, which he told me, was that the things you learn earliest in life are the ones you're least likely to challenge later on. So going to the toilet being one of them. So he's basically confounded the British way of going to the toilet, which is, basically the toilet is a kind of seat. And he was very impressed when he traveled to Asia about the Asian squatting position. So what he's built is a toilet which you can physically sit on, and it supports you in the squatting position. And he took advice from a nurse who has a PhD in continence. And the advice was that this is actually a much healthier way to do the action.
Well, very, very carefully put there. It has to be said, although it can seem frivolous, toilet technology is a huge area, especially for people in development work in Africa. I think there's a Bill Gates prize for newly designed toilets in Africa. We do have to move on. New technology has begun to disrupt taxi services around the world, and it's Uber, a firm which allows users to order up a ride via a smartphone app, which is making the most waves. Established taxi drivers and some regulators and politicians have cried foul. And this week, taxi drivers in London became the latest to announce a protest. Paris is one city where feelings about the new apps have been running high. And Christian Fraser took to the roads to find out why.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Christian.
I am Serge. Nice to meet you.
You're from Uber.
Yeah, I am.
Oh, great. Could you take me to the Champs-Élysées?
With pleasure, sir.
It's the next generation in car hire services. Serge is one of Uber's 600 chauffeurs in Paris who can be hired and paid for using an app on your smartphone.
This application is just incredible because you push the button, you have clients at any moment in the day.
So this is the plan of Paris.
Yes.
And you see where it's green? That means that they have a lot of clients here.
In
the centre, they have clients.
And it's proving equally convenient for the consumer. You decide which taxi is closest to you on the map. It's easy to pick the kind of car you want. And those clients we interviewed said it's often much cheaper than ordering a licence cab by phone.
Do you know where the car is? So you know exactly when it comes. Very often it's beautiful cars and taxis in Paris. It's not very beautiful cars, always late.
In a capital city with a modest 17,000 licensed taxis, technology is creating a more varied choice. Recently, all manner of new lift-sharing services have emerged. Uber, Lyft, Snapcar, just some of the apps now available. But where there are winners, there are also losers. Earlier this year, the licensed taxi drivers came out in protest, with hundreds of taxis blocking the city's main ring road, the Périphérique. Nordine Daman is a licensed taxi driver who paid over €200,000 for his taxi licence, a licence that is now worth far less. He's also a member of one of the main taxi drivers' unions.
Ça fait 20 ans que je fais ce métier. I've
been a taxi driver for 20 years and I've never seen such a drop in business. My turnover has been halved. If the government doesn't crack down on this fraud and stop the slow death of the French taxis, I swear we will block the whole country.
He has other concerns too. Who vets these drivers? To whom do they answer? Are the passengers they carry insured for personal injury? In a desperate attempt to placate the unions, the government set up a commission. The subsequent report sets out 30 recommendations.
You have a limited number of taxi drivers that has been broadly unchanged for the past 40 years.
Pierre-Dimitri Gorkorti is Uber's general manager for Western and Northern Europe. The row, he says, is bringing welcome reform to an industry that has resisted change for 40 years. But among the many proposals set out is a plan to ban Uber and other apps from pinpointing the nearest car on the map.
It's an example, once again, of a regulation that makes no sense, but to try and protect a monopoly. For now, until those recommendations are put in place, he continues to freeze the limo licenses, the VTC licenses. What that means is that we have 10% unemployment rate in France, and today, someone that wants to get his own business going, to buy a car and to get become a VTC driver, cannot do so.
If the government's proposals are adopted, then Uber may have to accept the new constraints with implications for other services across Europe. However, There are signs governments and city councils want to use this technology to encourage ride-sharing and reduce the number of cars in our cities. Wherever this particular route ends, there's no doubt it is forcing change, and that must be to the benefit of us, the consumer.
Christian Fraser in Paris. Stuart Miles, our special guest. These sharing apps, whatever you call them, they are having a big impact on traditional industries, aren't they?
They are. They're huge. They're very disruptive because, you know, they come in. Uber, in this case, are very lean. They're very aggressive. They've got cheaper prices. It's a good service. You pay by credit card. All these different things which you don't necessarily get with traditional services that you'd get into a black cab in London or a yellow cab in New York. And, you know, people are like that, and therefore they're using them more. And the traditionals are like, oh, you mean we've actually got to work for the customer?
It is extraordinary to watch that we're seeing the same thing in the hotel industry with Airbnb. But time to move on. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. As I said earlier, we've taken the show on the road and we've decamped to the BBC's Blue Room. I'm surrounded by gadgets. It's testing new devices to see how they interact with the broadcast industry. Lindsay Souter is in charge. Lindsay, we're standing in front of a bunch of TVs. Tell me what that's about.
We're standing in front of everything from a massive 55-inch curved display. We've got 4K TV, 4K being the ultimate picture, beautiful display. We've also got a whole row of connected TVs, apps everywhere, all over the place on TV.
It's a pretty confusing picture for viewers right now. You can connect your TV to the internet. Are people actually finding a way to do it?
They are, but we call it connected confusion because there's such a massive world of apps, it's confusing the consumer, I think, a great
deal.
We're walking
around here. I'm walking past an unmanned aerial vehicle, crudely known as a drone, used to take aerial pictures. We've come to some wearable technologies. A sign saying Things. What's that about?
So wearable, really big on the market at the moment. Things, we're referencing the Internet of Things. So we've got smartwatches, we've got wristbands to monitor health, and we've got Google Glass as well.
And is that really taking off?
Mixed response, I think. I love it. Other people don't. So I'll leave it there.
Yes, I've tried that too. Still, the jury's out. Now, we're standing in front of a 3D printer, and I think I can see a Raspberry Pi computer. What's this section about?
So this is our labs area. So 3D printing, really big at the moment. You can print out pretty much anything you want, design it online, send it to a printer, and you've got your physical 3D object there. So a great kind of way of designing what you want.
And creativity is a huge theme. Consumers who used to just be passive watchers of television or whatever have now got all these sort of tools in their hands.
They have, yeah. I mean, the Raspberry Pi, really big for the year of coding. Globally, it's a massive thing. Trying to get kids into coding kind of and using things like little bits, which are modular components. So really looking at getting kids into into coding.
Lindsay, thanks very much. Yes, bring kids around here. You'd have to tear them away from this fantastic array of gadgets. Do computer programmers, or geeks as some like to call them, have their own very distinct culture? The author and former computer programmer Vikram Chandra thinks so. He grew up in India, then moved to the US to work in the tech industry before becoming a novelist. He's now written a book called Geek Sublime, describing what he calls a macho programming culture. And I asked him how this came about and how it was different between the two countries.
I noticed quite early that in many ways, it was quite peculiar to me, this kind of, I guess, what has been termed geek machismo. The aggressiveness with which certain proclamations of skill and eliteness are made. And then I read this rather wonderful book by Nathan Ensminger called The Computer Boys Take Over. He's a historian of technology and science, and he does a wonderful job in laying out how, in the early days, all the programmers were women. Once everyone figured out programming was actually a very hard intellectual discipline and that it took considerable skill and insight to actually do it, the profession was slowly converted into a male profession.
When you came to America and started immersing yourself in this world, did that really hit you in the face, the fact that it was a really macho atmosphere? And is there a distinction between that and the Indian culture of programming?
Yes, it did. It did. And not that it was at that time especially any less male in India, but I think the way that knowledge production, high-level knowledge production, shapes itself and that the way the domain is coded culturally in India is very different. So there's the idea in India of the knowledgeable one, the scholar, the guru, as it were. That doesn't have this kind of warrior attitude attached to it. Often what this results in is that when Indians come over to the United States, and especially to Silicon Valley, their affect is seen as being not sufficiently male, not sufficiently aggressive, not sufficiently cowboy-like.
What's strange, though, is that Silicon Valley, you know, you think of as this incredibly liberal place. There are quite a few now female tech CEOs in Silicon Valley, but that macho culture when it comes to programming doesn't seem to be changing that much.
No. In fact, it's so deeply coded into the programming culture, and I think into the culture as a whole, the idea of the self-sufficient individual, the cowboy, the pioneer, who sort of makes war against nature and overcomes it, is very strongly coded into the American self-concept. And I can't help thinking that what is happening in programming is a subset of this larger cultural idiom.
And how will that change? Is there any sign that it's changing?
One way to think about it is to think about the relative success of Indian entrepreneurs and programmers in Silicon Valley. Vivek Wadhwa, who's an entrepreneur and scholar, argues that this is because the first people who actually broke through the glass ceiling had very open discussions about what they needed to do to allow others to get in. And so they set up mentorships and networks that mobilize capital and skill and training and so forth. If we want to see more diversity in the American landscape of programming, I think a kind of organized effort like that will be necessary.
Vikram Chandra there. Now let's end the program by discussing what excited us most this week. Stuart Miles, our special guest from Pocket Lint. You and I both had a go with something called Project Morpheus. Tell people about that.
Yes, it's not something out of Matrix, although you could think that it is. It's a virtual reality headset from Sony, and the idea is you plug it in. It's very much like the Oculus Rift, if you've heard of that, and then you're transported into a 3D world.
I had a go with that, and I was lost in a shark tank being attacked by sharks underwater, and I did find it very disconcerting. Jane Wakefield, anything particularly struck you this week?
Well, apart from finally understanding what net neutrality is, which I'm quite proud of myself for, I was pleased at how well a feature I wrote about the University of the People did. It seemed to go down really well on our website. It's about a university that offers free degrees to people in the developing world, so it's nice to sort of write about a bit of tech that's actually really helping people.
Oh, that does sound inspiring. And as for you, Dougal Shaw, what really excited you? More toilets?
Yes, at the risk of sounding like I'm obsessed with bathrooms, I had a look at some digital taps, which I thought these would be great. You just press a button, you say, this is the temperature I want, this is the volume of bath I want. Press it, off you go. You can even control it through an app on your phone in your house. And I thought, you know, everything else in our life is digitized, music, video, why not water as well?
Well, we've roamed far and wide. That's all we've got time for. Thanks to Stuart Miles and to Jane Wakefield and Dougal Shaw. Don't forget all those stories you've heard about this week. You can find it in more detail on the BBC News site at bbc.com/technology. Tweet us at BBC Tech 10, and please join us again next week.